Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Day 4 of Transforming Trauma Conference 2021. And this is Day 4. Today we're going to be talking, or actually Maria is going to be talking with Caitlin Axelrod. And she's an eating, she'll be talking about eating disorders and actually shame and all that stuff that's attached. So Maria will be here just in a second now.
When and on, we're going to get us started. Awesome. Thanks so much, Maria. I'm going to share my screen and we'll get started. All right, so welcome to everyone who has joined. My name is Caitlin Axelrod. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm the program and outreach coordinator at Sheena's Place. I'm also a social worker. You'll learn a bit more about Sheena's Place shortly, but just a little bit about myself, and then I'll pass it to Miranda. I've been in my role at Sheena's Place for 3 years now, and I've been involved in research and volunteering within the eating disorders field for about 8 years. I became interested in the field of eating disorders as a result of knowing a lot of people with lived experience and as a result of being a member of a society that is strongly influenced by diet culture and many conflicting messages about food and bodies. I'm really passionate about advocating for low barrier mental health support, as well as harm reduction and body inclusivity in my work at Sheena's Place and also in my work and life outside of Sheena's Place. And I will pass it over to Miranda.
Thanks, Caitlin. Hello, everyone. My name is Miranda Pecoraro, and I use the pronoun she, her. I'm a Master of Social Work student at the University of Toronto, specializing in the fields of health and mental health. And I have the opportunity to complete my practicum at Sheena's Place this year. I'm also a recent graduate of the Bachelor of Social Work program at the University of Windsor. I was drawn to complete my practicum at Sheena's Place because of my interest in group work, in community-based mental health, arts-based social work practice, women's health, and my desire to learn how to best support trauma survivors. I identify as a prospective feminist social worker, and I hope to pursue further training in the trauma field.
Thanks, Miranda. So before we get started with our content, we'd like to invite everyone to just take a moment to sit and reflect a little bit. So as we learn and reflect about eating disorders and trauma today, it's important that we recognize the systemic violence that some communities on the land we call Canada have faced and still face today. First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples often have their traditional methods of procuring food and their relationship with the land forcefully altered through the processes of settler colonization. The residential school system aims to sever these connections among children with exploitative processes and treaties that weren't upheld, creating the conditions for poverty that many unfortunately still live in to this day. As of November 2021, 43 public long-term boil water advisories remain in 31 communities, and 30 short-term public drinking water advisories exist, impacting all of these communities' ability to prepare and engage with food and impacting mental health and well-being. So as a charity providing support to those with body image issues and eating disorders, Sheena's Place acknowledges that First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples are often left out of body image and eating disorder spaces. This includes research, treatment, recovery spaces, and conversations surrounding stigma and support. It's our responsibility to work towards decolonizing these spaces and to create a supportive environment or many supportive environments for all folks who desire support. As non-Indigenous settlers, we see acknowledging these truths and actively working towards reconciliation as critical, especially in the context of learning about mental health, food, and trauma, and the way in which these things interact and intersect. If you want to learn more about ways that you can take action as an ally or to learn more about the land that you are on, we have a list of resources on the slide here, and we'd encourage you to check those out. And this is being recorded, so you're welcome to revisit this slide in order to take a look. All right. So today, this is what we will be covering. So we'll start with an introduction to Sheena's Place. I will talk about eating disorders, what they are, the basics, busting some common myths, and then I'll pass it over to Miranda to talk about the link between eating disorders and childhood sexual abuse, as well as trauma more broadly. And then we'll provide some recommendations for providing support as well as some community referrals and resources specific to eating disorders. And lastly, we'll end with questions. So before we start talking about Sheena's Place and eating disorders, just a few little housekeeping things. We would love for you to ask questions. We'll be pausing once in the middle and then once at the end for questions. So you're welcome to ask those in the Q&A or in the chat, and we will do our best to answer. As well, know that this content might bring up a lot of difficult emotions. You know, we all have our own relationships with food and our bodies. Many of us may have experiences of trauma. And so please take care of yourself. Take breaks. If you have to leave, we will not be offended at all. This content, like I said, is being recorded, and so you're welcome to revisit it later on, or if you decide this is not the right time for you, that's totally okay as well. As well, please eat during this webinar. If this is a meal or snack time for you, it's really important for us to normalize that. And then our last note here is that, you know, Miranda and I are presenting from our own personal and professional context. This presentation will not represent every perspective or approach. So please take what feels relevant to you and leave the rest. And we really do encourage a lot of critical thinking here. Okay, so Sheena's Place. We'll talk a little bit about Sheena's Place at the beginning, and also a little bit more at the end around how to access support. So we are a community mental health charity that supports people affected by eating disorders. So we offer a wide range of professionally facilitated groups and workshops. We don't do any individual counseling or treatment, but we have many, many different types of groups. So right now we are offering around 30 weekly online groups. These fall into different categories, including support, skill building, body image, expressive art, and nutrition. We also offer educational webinars throughout the year. All of our groups and programs are free of charge, and everything is based on self-referral. So this means that nobody needs an eating disorder diagnosis or a doctor's referral to access support. We provide support to anyone ages 17 and older residing in Ontario. You don't need an OHIP card, and this doesn't need to be your full-time residence, but as long as you are accessing our groups from Ontario, that's what needs to happen. So as you can see in the photo here, we're typically, pre-COVID, located in a very warm and welcoming, non-institutional, non-clinical type of house in the Annex in Toronto. However, we are still running all of our groups online as a result of the pandemic. We do hope to move into a hybrid model where we are providing both online and in-person group support. But fingers crossed that will happen in the spring. We'll provide a little bit more information about registration and our program at the end as well for anyone who's interested for themselves or anyone they know. Okay. So what is an eating disorder? Before I dive into this, I want to acknowledge that the term eating disorder is being used in this presentation for consistency. But we acknowledge that this term might not resonate with everyone. And I'll speak a little bit more about the terminology of disorder or the meaning of diagnoses in a moment. But with that being said, like all mental health challenges, eating disorders occur on a spectrum. And so we all fall somewhere along the spectrum, and that can change over time or depending on context. So on the left-hand side of this image, you'll see positive relationship with food and the body. So someone who is engaging in more flexible, balanced, and intuitive eating and movement, someone who experiences higher levels of body acceptance or body neutrality, so not necessarily that someone's loving their body all the time, but they're feeling okay about it, and someone whose self-esteem and self-worth are not solely defined by the body. So someone who experiences all of those things might fall more towards the left of this spectrum. As we move towards the middle, you'll see what we have named disordered eating symptoms. Now, many of these symptoms are actually quite normalized in our society. And despite having the label of disordered, many of these symptoms are actually quite normal responses to what we might call disordered or abnormal or traumatic situations. So as we move then to the right, you'll see diagnoses. And these are based on the DSM, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. I won't go into detail about all of these. As a social worker, it's not my role to be diagnosing anyone. And like I said, at Sheena's Place, diagnoses are not required. But just to share some of the common language that you may have already heard of, or that may be helpful to know, I'll share just a little bit about each of these terms. So binge eating disorder, this is the most common eating disorder diagnosis. This involves engaging in episodes of binge eating. So this means eating an objectively large amount of food in a discrete period of time and feeling a loss of control while doing so. So binge eating is not about, you know, eating a bit past the point of fullness or eating seconds or thirds of your favorite meal. It's really about this loss of control. Binge eating disorder was only added to the DSM in 2013, and so it's quite under-recognized, both in research and in practice. But like I said, it is the most common eating disorder. Next, bulimia nervosa. So this is characterized by cycles of binge eating and purging. Essentially, purging means an attempt to compensate for the binge through various means, so that could include self-induced vomiting, over-exercise, the misuse of laxatives or diuretics, fasting, or medication misuse. So one example of that is in the case of diabetes. If folks are not taking their insulin in the way that it's prescribed, this could essentially act as a form of purging or compensating, and that can be quite dangerous. Next, anorexia nervosa. This is another term you may have heard of. This involves an intense obsession with restricting and controlling one's eating, paired with an intense fear of gaining weight. So to be diagnosed with anorexia nervosa, there are a lot of different criteria, including criteria around weight or BMI. That's not something I'm going to be focusing on, but I do just want to acknowledge that ironically, most people who experience symptoms of anorexia do not meet that low weight criteria. And so folks may receive a diagnosis of atypical anorexia, which actually falls into, you see the acronyms at the bottom of the list here, OSFED and UFED. Atypical anorexia falls within there. And it is just as harmful or dangerous to a person's health and well-being as anorexia nervosa. Very briefly as well, PICA is another type of eating disorder. The classification in the DSM is actually eating and feeding disorders, but some of these fall under different categories. I'm not going to get too caught up in the details here. But PICA is essentially the persistent eating of non-nutritive substances, so things that are not food. Rumination disorder is the repeated regurgitation of food that does not have to do with self-induced vomiting, so it's more related to a person's gag reflex. Oh, and I skipped one. Avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, also known as ARFID. This might really resemble anorexia in that a person is restricting their food intake quite drastically. They're maybe only eating a very small range of things. But the difference is it's not about body image or fear of weight gain. It is more around extreme picky eating, so really not being able to eat certain textures or tastes. And this is more common among children, but people of all ages and backgrounds and demographics can experience it. Lastly, one that I will mention is orthorexia. Now, this has a star beside it because it is not technically a diagnosis in the DSM. That being said, it is something that we're seeing more and more frequently over the years. And essentially what this describes is an extreme or unhealthy obsession with eating, quote unquote, healthy or clean, and it's often accompanied by compulsive exercise. So as you can imagine, this is a lot harder to spot in a society that has certain values around what a person should be doing when it comes to eating and exercise and moralizing those behaviors. So before I move on to the next slide, just a couple of quick notes around diagnoses. So diagnoses can be really helpful and validating for many people. It can be helpful for people to have a way to describe what they're experiencing, knowing that they're not the only one experiencing that. And diagnoses can also be problematic, especially in the context of eating disorders, for a few reasons. The first is that, well, in general, the DSM is quite scaled to white norms, and these categories can be less helpful when talking to people who are not white and whose first language is not English. So that's more general. Specific to eating disorders as well, there are many barriers to acquiring a diagnosis. And as always, individual experiences don't always fit neatly into these categories. We know as well that diagnoses do not necessarily indicate the severity of a person's eating disorder or eating challenges, I should say. And certainly a diagnosis does not dictate a person's worthiness or need for treatment and support. There are many, many people without a diagnosis who still are in dire need of treatment and support. And this is really unfortunate because in Canada especially, a diagnosis is often a gatekeeper to accessing treatment. So to access publicly funded hospital treatment, a person generally needs an eating disorder diagnosis. And seeing as there are many barriers to accessing that, it can be really difficult for people who don't. And, you know, this is understandable given the lack of resources and the fact that we need to be triaging people. However, it's, again, really, really unfortunate as many people are not getting the life-saving support that they need. And lastly, when it comes to any kind of diagnosis, thinking about labels and the impact of labels. So if you are someone who either, you know, has lived experience, if you're someone who supports other people or both, thinking about, you know, how, like what the impact of a label is or a diagnosis is on your experience, on their experience. And I encourage you to have those conversations with people you support or people in your life. Okay, so moving on to recognizing some signs of disordered eating. This is not an exhaustive list. I'll give you a moment just to read through the list on your own, and then I'll make a couple of comments about it. So one thing I will mention is that, you know, a person might exhibit many of these signs or very few. Every person's experience is quite different. When it comes to, you'll see the first item on the physical changes side is abnormal weight gain or loss. This may or may not happen. It really depends on the individual and their metabolism, their own individual person and body. And even if this is happening, it might not be readily observable. And a lot of things on both lists might not be readily observable, even if they are happening. And this is because there can often be a lot of stigma and shame surrounding eating disorder symptoms. And so folks might be going to great lengths to hide some of these signs or their symptoms. And of course, each one of these things doesn't necessarily mean someone has an eating disorder or disordered eating. We know that any one of those things, these things alone can indicate many other issues going on. But all of that to say, these are some signs, warning signs to look out for. Okay, moving right along. When it comes to the prevalence and severity of eating disorders, we know that based on global prevalence data, it's estimated that 2.7 million people in Canada have an eating disorder. That's a lot of people. That's recently been increased from the prior estimate of 1 million. We also know that eating disorders have the second highest mortality rate of all mental illnesses, and is the second to opioid addiction. The leading causes of death for people with eating disorders are those that you see listed here, so suicide and cardiovascular failure as a result of restriction, use of diet pills and laxatives, and self-induced vomiting. So people with all different types of eating disorder symptoms can be quite at risk. It's not just restriction, as many people often think. When it comes to the pandemic, we've seen rates and the severity of eating disorders increase. We'll speak a little bit more to that shortly about why that might be the case for many people. And lastly, early intervention leads to greater chances of recovery. And so if this applies to you or someone you know, encouraging them or yourself to seek support as soon as possible is a great idea. Oh, one thing I forgot to mention on this slide, when it comes to the severity or mortality related to eating disorders, it is not dependent on a person's body weight or size. People of all sizes can experience detrimental physical and mental health consequences related to eating disorders. So that's one myth I'll speak a little bit more to shortly as well. All right, so moving along, I'll now cover three myths about eating disorders before passing it over to Miranda. So the first common myth about eating disorders is that they are a choice. So we might hear people talking about an eating disorder being like a diet gone too far, or that someone just needs to start eating or stop doing what they're doing. But in reality, like all mental illnesses or mental health challenges, eating disorders develop as a result of diverse biological, psychological, and social and cultural factors. So it's not as simple as just choosing to have one. Like a person wouldn't choose to have depression or schizophrenia or any other difficulty that they might be living with. So some examples of biological factors include genetics. We know that between, I think, 28 and 74% of inheritability of eating disorders is, the risk of eating disorders is through genetic heritability, so that can be quite high, especially for anorexia and bulimia. Other aspects of biology, like the medication someone's on, is that influencing their appetite or their weight, and therefore having an impact on their risk? When it comes to environmental factors, you know, messages that family and peers growing up are sending someone. So if someone grows up in an environment where they're receiving certain messages about food, bodies, eating, all of that, that can increase a person's risk. As well, societal beauty standards, social media, living in a culture of always comparing oneself to others, and experiencing discrimination and oppression also increase the risk. Lastly, when it comes to psychological factors, we have certain personality traits that are more linked to certain symptoms. This includes perfectionism and impulsivity, body image and self-esteem, so how a person feels about themselves, which is of course influenced by all of these other things, and emotion regulation and stress management. So a lot of that is quite individual, whereas one person with a set of experiences might, let's say, end up developing like a substance use challenge, that like a different person with very similar circumstances might develop an eating disorder, kind of filling some of the same functions. The last thing I'll mention here is that most often people with eating disorders also have additional mental health challenges. This is usually depression and anxiety, as well as obsessive compulsive disorder, substance use challenges, and PTSD or experiences of trauma, which we will of course be talking about more shortly. All right, so moving on to myth number two, that eating disorders are exclusively about food and weight. This is a very common myth. In reality, eating disorder symptoms serve many different functions, and while food and weight can be a part of the picture, it's usually not the entire picture. So the light green boxes here represent some common functions. The dark green boxes represent not necessarily functions, but other factors that perpetuate an eating disorder or interfere with recovery. So I'll give you a moment just to look through those. So as you can imagine, many of these do connect to trauma and to childhood sexual abuse. So I won't go into detail here, and Miranda will be touching more on some of these. I will just name for now that coping with negative emotions is one of the most common ones, or kind of numbing out or trying to avoid memories or difficult emotions. And then when it comes to COVID as well and the pandemic, certain factors here are especially relevant. So again, that includes coping with difficult emotions, people who've experienced a lot of anxiety or grief or sadness, loss, loneliness, all of that throughout the pandemic, as well as you know, maintaining control in uncertainty in a world that looks very uncertain. There's a lot going on that's unexpected. It's logical that someone might try to maintain control over their food or movement, especially for people who are already at risk of having an eating disorder for other reasons. And then lastly, you know, a loss of formal and informal support as well. That's something that we've of course seen in many fields, in many areas throughout the pandemic, and food scarcity as well. So that is connected to an increased risk to the development of eating disorders, and with folks losing jobs and financial insecurity becoming increasingly common, it then makes sense that food scarcity would also be increasing for many people. Okay, so moving on to our last myth for today. This is around who is affected by an eating disorder. So a common myth persists that eating disorders only affect thin, white, wealthy adolescent girls or young women. And in reality, eating disorders do not discriminate. People of all ages, races, and ethnicities, gender identity, sexual orientation, income levels, abilities, and body shapes and sizes are affected. On the next slide, I will share a few statistics regarding some groups of people who are at a higher risk or who are affected. My intention in doing this is not to reduce people to numbers. We know that every individual's experience is quite different. Rather, it's to speak to what exists in the, unfortunately, mostly American and quite limited literature and research. So a few stats here. First, around men. So approximately 20% of people living with eating disorders are boys and men. This is quite surprising to many people. As I mentioned, they're often thought of as a woman's or a female disorder or illness. As well, people identifying as members of the 2S LGBTQI plus community experience eating disorders at up to 5 times the rate of their cisgender heterosexual counterparts. And this is especially true for trans and non-binary folks. Next, people who experience food insecurity, as I mentioned, are more likely to develop an eating disorder than those who do not. This is for a few different reasons, one being the stress of being in this situation. Also, not having stable access to food can understandably really impact a person's relationship with food. And so unintentionally restricting can make someone then more likely to binge eat, for example. And the body really can't tell the difference between intentional versus unintentional restriction. When it comes to race, people of color are just as likely to have eating disorders as white people. However, people of color are less likely to access treatment and support. This is because of a lack of treatment and support options that are relevant and appropriate. It's also due to under-recognition on the side of healthcare providers. There are many different reasons why this is the case. People with disabilities and neurodivergence may also be more likely to experience eating disorders than those without. There's less research in this area, but one specific intersection that is quite common is between anorexia and autism. The correlation there is quite high. And then lastly, people of all shapes and sizes can experience all types of eating disorders and symptoms. And so we really can't look at someone and based on their weight or any other aspect of their identity, determine what they're going through, what type of symptom they have, or if they don't have an eating disorder. If we think back to the biopsychosocial model, it's evident that many of the folks with the identities listed above, so for example, people of color, queer folks, people with disabilities, and people in larger bodies experience higher levels of oppression, discrimination, and trauma, contributing to their elevated risk. And there is some research pointing that out. The last thing I'll mention here is that, of course, these assumptions and stereotypes can be really harmful as they prevent people who don't fit the stereotype from receiving support, either because a person, you know, if they see, whether that's in the media or like Netflix movies that come out, if they're like, oh, this is what an eating disorder looks like, well, I can't have an eating disorder because I don't look like that, or I'm not a part of that same group of people. And as I mentioned, recognition on the part of healthcare providers is also a big issue. So there was a study done several years ago, for example, showing that when doctors examined Black women with eating disorders and white women with eating disorders, the same symptoms, they're more likely to diagnose an eating disorder in the white women. And so there are a lot of different areas here that must be targeted in terms of awareness and increasing visibility for folks who are often overlooked in this field. So I will now pass it over to Miranda to take us through the next section.
Thank you, Caitlin. Okay, so transitioning now into the link to childhood sexual abuse. The literature tells us that childhood sexual abuse, or CSA, I might refer to it as that throughout the presentation, is a risk factor for the development of eating disorders and specifically binging and purging behaviors. Further, people who experience CSA are more likely to engage in binging and purging than those who do not have a history of CSA. To give some context, studies suggest that 30% of people with eating disorders have experienced CSA, and it's also been suggested that 67% of people with eating disorders have experienced at least one traumatic life event. So there are some possible explanations for this, and these include self-esteem, self-worth, and body image, coping with emotions, and coping with a lack of control. So children and youth are in the process of developing their identities, sense of self, and core beliefs. So therefore, CSA can seriously impact a person's sense of self and worth and body image. Experiencing low self-esteem and body image dissatisfaction are both risk factors for developing an eating disorder. As well, sexual abuse can lead to dissociation from the body. This might manifest as body shame, self-hatred, and maybe the urge to self-harm. Eating disorder behaviors can be used as a way to cope with feelings of shame and as a way to engage in self-harm. People who experience abuse also need ways of coping with intense emotions. So often folks will turn to substance use, self-harm, and eating disorder behaviors to cope with negative or difficult emotions. And again, this often shows up as binging and purging behaviors. A little bit more information on that. Binging and purging can temporarily reduce anxiety or negative emotions, and it can also serve to numb emotions. Restriction in this regard can also serve to numb emotions as well. Many survivors also feel a lack of control after abuse, and eating disorder behaviors might come in to serve as a way to feel in control again, and perhaps in control of their bodies in particular. So this might be through restricting food intake, exercising, purging, et cetera. Because thinness is also seen as a beauty ideal in Western culture, for some people, weight gain through binge eating might be seen as a protective mechanism to prevent further victimization. So this might be seen as a way to desexualize the body. It's also important to remember here that weight loss or gain can be especially triggering, as survivors might associate a specific weight with their abuse. Some other important considerations here, as Caitlin has mentioned, most research here has been conducted with women and can thus not necessarily be generalized to people of all genders and all backgrounds. We know that men make up approximately 20 to 25% of people with eating disorders, and that trans and non-binary folks are also more likely than cisgender individuals to develop an eating disorder. Okay, so moving on to what recovery might look like. Thank you, Caitlin. So it's different for every person. Despite the severity of all eating disorders, recovery is certainly possible with proper treatment. And like I said, it will vary from person to person, but for many, it can include developing a more regular, attuned, and intuitive eating pattern, developing more positive or neutral body image, and developing alternative, healthier coping skills. So the most effective treatment programs included here under psychotherapy, we'll be discussing a little bit further, but they're also involved. It also involves nutrition counseling, support groups, and when necessary, sometimes psychiatric medication. So under this psychotherapy branch, we've listed a few modalities here. Family-based therapy, or the Maudsley method, is the most evidence-based form of psychotherapy. But keep in mind this is only for adolescents with restrictive symptoms and secure family environments. CBTE, which is enhanced cognitive behavioral therapy for bulimia and binge eating. Important to keep in mind here too that CBT is contraindicated for anorexia because of malnutrition. CBT uses a variety of generic cognitive and behavioral interventions like addressing cognitive biases, but instead it favors the use of strategic changes in behavior to modify thinking rather than direct cognitive restructuring. As well, DBT is recommended for bulimia and binge eating, as this focuses on emotion regulation and a lot of skill-based learning, as well as radically open DBT for anorexia and for others who might struggle with over-control symptoms. Motivational interviewing is also recommended to address ambivalence towards change, and acceptance and commitment therapy to address body image distress. There's also some evidence for psychoanalysis and psychodynamic therapy, And what that might entail is encouraging clients to consider how eating disorder behaviors might reenact a certain aspect or sensation or experience of abuse. As well here, on the note of medication, no medication directly treats eating disorders, but can help with concurrent mental health challenges, thereby helping with the eating disorder. So for instance, some studies show a very high co-occurrence between ADHD and binge eating disorder. So treating ADHD with Vyvanse has been shown to help many people with binge eating disorder symptoms. Okay. And on the next slide, we have some general best practices for providing support. Firstly, remaining empathetic and non-judgmental. Here, the stress is validating emotions for clients, as many clients who present with eating disorders tend to feel very isolated and alone. It's important not to make assumptions based on what you see, for example, what symptoms you think you might be seeing. And to remember that a client might hold different ideas about health. If you are a provider, we suggest not automatically suggesting exercise as a coping strategy, as this could be part of one's eating disorder. And there's also an emphasis on wanting to understand what's going on underneath the surface. So focusing too much on the eating disorder symptoms might actually be seen as counterproductive, and focusing instead on the underlying issues might be more productive. With regard to working with shame is something that often shows up after experiencing trauma and can thus also be very tied to disordered eating. If people feel shame as a result of trauma, then engage in eating disorder behaviors to cope. This can then add layers of shame. This is due to the stigma that exists around eating disorder behaviors. It's important to reinforce that an eating disorder, just like how someone experiencing trauma is not at fault for experiencing that, an eating disorder is not a choice, and it's not someone's fault. Psychoeducation in this regard can be very helpful, as it can help with shame around specific behaviors. For example, educating someone who is experiencing binge eating on the restrict binge cycle could be useful. And it's also useful to frame these behaviors as self-protective as opposed to self-sabotage. Another recommendation here is to avoid saying, "You've got nothing to be ashamed of," as this can actually create secondary shame. So that's like shame for feeling shameful. Moving on here, to reflect on our own biases and beliefs about foods and bodies, we are constantly inundated with messages that thin bodies are healthy and fat or larger bodies are unhealthy. So we need to unlearn this and adopt a health and every size belief system. So this is something that is very difficult to do and takes a lot of time, but it's very important. Critically analyzing social media and changing up who we follow can be a really helpful part of this process. It's also important to acknowledge and validate your own feelings and to engage in self-care. And for some people, this might include therapy or formal support if possible. With our bodies and with food, and this might not be something that you're comfortable or ready to discuss with clients. So it's important to honor that, and if you're a provider, to refer out when it's necessary. Moving on here to mindfulness around language. So this would entail observing how diet culture can be very sneaky and sneak its way into our vocabulary. So using words like overindulge, guilty pleasure, or binging on Netflix. It's important to avoid commenting on the appearance or food choices of ourselves or others as well. And remember that recognizing or placing value on weight loss or gain can be especially triggering for survivors, as some survivors might associate a specific weight with a specific experience of abuse. Okay, for safety and boundary setting, boundaries can help create safety and predictability, and for many folks who've experienced trauma, this is not always commonplace. Therapists should clearly articulate how client confidentiality and privacy will be respected, and should provide clear information as to what clients can expect to occur during their treatment or while engaging with a service provider. So, for example, in Sheena's Place groups, we have a set of guidelines that support group member safety and predictability. So some of these guidelines include no one new will arrive after the first 5 minutes. and we won't name specific eating disorder details, diagnoses, et cetera, that might be triggering, numbers of specific foods, numbers or specific foods like calorie intake, weight, anything like that, or specific trauma details, as that might also be triggering. The trauma of CSA, which is characterized by power imbalances, must be counteracted by relationships in which survivors feel equal and respected. So therapists should be aware of the inherent power discrepancy in the therapeutic relationship and should work to minimize that if possible. So ways that this can be done is the service can be structured in such a way to ensure that clients reserve the right to direct and guide the treatment. This might include refusing to answer questions, declining particular interventions, and having a say in the services that they receive. And a provider should consider involving all clients in the stages of their planning and assessment of services. To put this practice into action, Sheena's Place offers completely voluntary services and solicits feedback from clients regarding the specific groups they attend, as well as experiences with the organization overall to instill that spirit of collaboration. As well here, some of the coercive and punitive methods, including the use of a reward or punishment system, invasiveness or a lack of privacy that is sometimes adopted by eating disorder treatment centers, might be experienced as unsuitable or inappropriate given the client's trauma history. Again, as sexual abuse is about an exploitation of power, any intervention that takes away power from the hands of a survivor could be re-traumatizing. Okay, so coming up here to a focus on skill building. As spoken about earlier, eating disorder symptoms serve as a survival mechanism for coping with trauma. So recognizing that as dangerous as eating disorder symptoms are, they are still vital in the absence of other safer coping strategies. So in order to relinquish symptoms that serve as a survival strategy, it's important to find alternative safe ones. So Sheena's Place groups have an emphasis on skill building, and they often incorporate DBT and other skill-based application work, and this is to equip members with alternative means of coping. Next, the use of harm reduction. So this entails understanding that a person is doing the best they can and that eating disorder symptoms reflect an attempt to cope with difficult emotions or situations. So in essence, they are doing the best they can in this given moment. So telling someone to just stop is not effective. Alternative coping strategies must be explored and developed, as well to keep in mind that we cannot abstain from food in a way that you might be able to abstain from another given substance. So the focus here is how can we support people in minimizing the harm associated with the symptoms. Acknowledging the impact of systemic trauma is also very significant. So systemic oppression, racism, transphobia, fatphobia, et cetera, and the trauma caused by these forces of oppression can influence the development of eating disorders. For instance, those who experience the impact of diet culture most are those whose bodies are also marginalized and maybe marginalized in more way than one. And as stated earlier, there's also a growing body of research on the relationship between food insecurity and the development of eating disorders. So in practice, one might consider tuning into the cross-cultural differences within the client-worker relationship and the impact of one's own social location on the therapeutic relationship. As well, recognizing these systemic forces might enable a client to externalize their eating disorder behaviors or their shame. Lastly here, another recommendation is to emphasize strengths and provide encouragement. So treatment methods that focus on the pathology of eating disorders or other self-destructive behaviors characteristic of those who have experienced CSA can cause a lot of damage. Because this might perpetuate a client's already low self-esteem or experiences of shame. So it might be wise to consider to encourage the person to see themselves as more than their eating disorder, to emphasize their strengths and to encourage them to seek support if they are ready to. And you can assess readiness using the stages of change model. So with that, I'll pass it over back to Caitlin.
Thanks, Miranda. So before we move into a bit more information about Sheena's Place and the question period, this graphic is just a really, I think, nice visualization to end on. As Miranda just mentioned, stages of change, often there can be a lot of ambivalence towards recovery in the eating disorders sphere. And that's because, like Miranda said, eating disorder symptoms are serving an important function in a person's life. And so often for folks who are going through recovery, whatever that means to them, it can really feel like we're moving in circles. Or even as a provider, it can feel like a person is going in circles. And so I really like the reframe of that. If we look to the side, what's actually happening is this upward spiral where a person is making progress, even if it doesn't feel like it or seem like it. All right. So a little bit more about Sheena's Place programs. As I mentioned at the beginning, we offer many different groups every week. Some of our groups do fill up like right away as soon as registration opens. However, we do have drop-in groups that have space all the way throughout the season, every week of the year. So our drop-in groups that we are currently offering are listed here. As you can see, we have some general groups, like our adult support group, our young adult support group, as well as some more demographic-specific groups. We also have a support group for family, friends, and partners of folks with eating disorders. I would strongly encourage anyone interested in learning more, whether you are someone seeking support for yourself or someone else, to attend one of our information sessions. We offer them every couple of weeks online. We actually have one this afternoon, so if you visit our website, I'll also put the link in the chat. There should be information right on the homepage of the website for how to access that. Next, just a couple more FAQs about Sheena's Place. As I mentioned, all of our groups are free of charge. They are all online using Zoom for healthcare. Groups are typically 10 to 12 weeks long, running once weekly for about an hour and a half. And sharing is not mandatory in our groups. And so this is really important from like a trauma-informed lens that we want to create as many options for participation as possible. And so we invite people to introduce themselves, but especially in the first couple of groups, folks are welcome to do more listening than speaking, and we would never pressure anyone to share anything beyond what they are comfortable with. In terms of numbers, it really varies. We register between 12 and 15 people usually for groups. Something like yoga would be higher, or some of the skills groups might be higher, but typically we'll see between 7 and 15 people attending a group. This slide's a little outdated. And then, as I mentioned, eligibility criteria is on the slide, and I will also share a link to learn more about programs and registration in the chat. One last thing I'll mention is that in a week from today, we are celebrating our 25th anniversary with a virtual free event where we will be screening a couple of films that have been created about our organization and various people involved. And so I will share the link to that too, and anyone here is welcome to join. Before we move to questions, and I realized I said I would pause for questions in the middle and then did not, so I'm so sorry about that, but it looks like we'll have about 10 minutes. So before we do that, just a few treatment resources. I'm also happy to make these slides available to anyone. I can share them with Maria if that would be helpful. But here are some eating disorder treatment programs listed here in the GTA. I'll bring your attention to the top here, NEDIC, the National Eating Disorder Information Center. They are not a direct treatment program themselves, but they provide information about everything that's available across Canada eating disorder related. So I would highly encourage folks to reach out to them. They also have a toll-free helpline. Next, some support options across Canada and as well as internationally. So that includes Sheena's Place, as well as many other organizations providing different types of support, some of that being peer support, which is really important as well, and some demographic-specific support, as well as support for caregivers. Next, we have some general information about eating disorders. I should have mentioned everything underlined in these slides is hyperlinked, so if you do get a copy, you're able to access all of the information, and then some training options for healthcare providers. And lastly, some more resources about, Miranda mentioned something called Health at Every Size. If you're curious to learn more about that, about weight stigma and fat phobia, as well as intuitive eating and harm reduction in the context of eating disorders, here are a set of articles that are some of our favorites and some podcasts as well. So with that, we have about 10 minutes for questions. So if anyone would like to share, go for it. I'm getting lots of requests for the slides. What I can try to do, I can try and just share them in the chat right now, and then maybe folks will be able to download them if I can. I take that back. I can't share from my actual computer. My apologies. So I see a question here. Do you have to be in Ontario for courses? So for Sheena's Place groups, yes, a person does need to be in Ontario. That's because our facilitators are all registered with various colleges and regulatory bodies. And so that's our kind of blanket requirement. That being said, the resources on this slide here, so below Sheena's Place, we have Eating Disorders Nova Scotia, Looking Glass. There are a few other organizations here that would provide support to people outside of Ontario. I know there's a lot of content to sit with, so no worries. If people need time to process or asking questions, you can wait a few minutes, and if not, that's totally okay too. In the meantime, I will share those links in the chat that I mentioned. Yeah, so I see a question here. Can you speak more about DBT, so dialectical behavior therapy, in the context of eating disorder support? Like Miranda mentioned, this has been shown to be quite effective for people experiencing bulimia or binge eating disorder, so symptoms like binging and purging. This is because DBT really focuses on stress tolerance, emotion regulation, and symptom interruption. It was originally designed for folks with borderline personality disorder who experience sometimes high levels of suicidality, and so symptom interruption there is quite important as like a safety strategy and technique. So similar work can support with eating disorder recovery as well. Miranda also mentioned RODBT, which is a newer form, radically open DBT, and this is designed to support people who fall kind of on the other side of the control spectrum. So if we think about folks who might be most likely to benefit from traditional DBT, folks who we might consider are more under control, so need support in developing an ability to regulate emotions and control behavior. Whereas for some folks who experience restrictive eating disorders like anorexia, they may already have really high levels of control and rigidity, and so supporting them in developing even more control and rigidity is actually not helpful. And so radically open DBT kind of does the opposite in supporting people to increase flexibility and decrease rigidity in their behaviors. If you have any more specific questions, I'm happy to answer. Another question here I have. Yeah, so IBS, aggravated by stress, experience of not eating. Oh, that's a good question. I think for some people, like we mentioned at the beginning, like diagnoses can be really validating and helpful. And other times it doesn't really matter or it's not all that helpful. I think ultimately if eating and movement behaviors are causing physical challenges or mental health challenges and distress, then it is definitely worth seeking support for those things. Gastrointestinal challenges and eating disorders also do often go hand in hand. For many people with different GI challenges, whether that's like Crohn's, IBS, celiac, there can be a lot of like restriction that's inherent in sometimes the treatment for those things or recommendations from healthcare providers around like elimination diets. And so that can really increase the risk of developing like really rigid eating in a way that's not actually helpful to health and well-being, especially for IBS, because it's such a like broad category of challenge. Elimination diets are often recommended, and from what I've heard, you know, it's often actually not super helpful. If, you know, certain foods are really aggravating, to maybe eat less of those foods, but to like eliminate things entirely can really set someone up to experience more pain and discomfort. And one last thing I'll mention here is that a really common symptom of restriction and not eating enough food is GI discomfort. And so I can see why for someone experiencing that discomfort, they might not want to eat as a way to help with that, but that actually can make it worse. And so continuing to eat regularly can be really important and helpful for the GI system. I hope that was helpful. And of course, everyone's different, so please take these answers with a few grains of salt. Maybe we'll give it one more minute, see if anyone else has questions. I'll share my email in the chat as well. If anyone has questions following the presentation, you're always welcome to reach out. Okay, well, maybe Maria, I'll pass it back over to you. It doesn't sound like you have any more questions for now.
Thanks, Caitlin. Thank you, everyone, for being here today and sharing the space with us. Thank you, Miranda, as well, and Sheena Spence. And again, congratulations on 25 years of service to the community, very much needed in these, especially during some strange times that we're going through the planet. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Our next presentation is at 5 p.m., and it is PTSD. So please do some self-care between now and then, and we'll see everyone back at 5 again. Thank you so much to both of you and your organization for the tremendous work you're doing in our community. Have a safe and wonderful rest of your day, everyone. Thank you.